We are not forgotten chapter of their history. They are a little chapter in our history.
Welcome to the third episode of The Process, where we follow one artist through a work in progress to see where it lands. My name is Laurent John, and I'm the studio's coordinator here at Somerset House. In this episode, we're moving out of the studios to follow the artist Shiraz Beju as he works on a new commission for an exhibition here called We Are History, looking at the legacy of colonialism on the climate crisis. Shiraz was born in Mauritius and lives between there and London. He works across several mediums, bringing lots of different elements into dialogue with one another. And for this exhibition, he was commissioned to make a new work, exploring different perspectives on the plantation system and its structures of extraction and subjugation. Here, he looks at strategies of survival and resistance in the Indian Ocean region with the activist and theorist Françoise Vergès to consider how language can be decolonized. A warning, there is some sensitive content here about race and slavery.
You know, in the late 60s and early 70s, the questions of decolonization were not academic pursuits. Countries were having to build themselves out. They had to figure out, well, how do we define ourselves now? What is the language that we start to imagine ourselves through? And obviously so much of that is language that has been created through empire, you know, through the colonial project. And so these are often also ideas that we've come to realize are ideas of ourselves that we have inherited from outside voices. And so places like Mauritius, for me, are very important in helping us to understand, you know, the nature of that language, that the nature of how patriarchal language has sort of embedded itself in so many ways that we imagine ourselves, but also our civic institutions, which is why this language is important, and important that it's authored by communities themselves. We've got to sand off this filler. Wet the wood. The sculpture is made from Sapele wood, which is it's sort of like a 2 meter tall sort of post, very dark kind of mahogany wood. And coming out of that are two sort of flag or sail posts, which will have these kanga fabrics hanging from them. And then on these little shelves, you've got these sort of pieces of white coral and old archive photographs and little bits of ceramic and gold chain. So, not actually that dissimilar to my painting, you know, adding layers, removing them, adding them back. The broader focus of my work, it's, you know, very much focused on the Western Indian Ocean region. I mean, partly because it is a place that I've come from, but also because in terms of the Mascarene Islands, these are islands that, you know, they were uninhabited before European colonization. And so they are really, you know, extreme experiments, you could almost call them, of the slave system, because Mauritius was certainly a site of major French plantations, but it's also the place where the British experimented the indentured labor system, which was then rolled out across the British Empire. So, you know, these sites have witnessed some of the biggest parts of our social and economic history of the last 200 years. One of the series that's going into the exhibition is this ceramic series called Coral Island. This is made up of these sort of classical French framed ceramic pieces and these Dutch etchings by the sailors who were arriving in the Mascarene Islands at the end of the 1600s, beginning of the 17th century. And they were describing these islands of paradise where they knew that they were uninhabited because the birds used to fly into their hands. And in these drawings, you often see these sort of depictions of men clubbing birds. And so we start to see, perhaps in some of these early drawings, some of the psyche and thinking of this relationship of extraction. they start to kind of bring together, align this idea of sort of mastery over nature and the environment, rather than perhaps, you know, as we find with lots of Indigenous First Nations communities, you know, the language of actually living in harmony and in balance with the resources that are available to you. For me, it's about bringing these different types of things into sort of an orbit or a kind of constellation with each other. And together it starts to kind of create these kind of cross-sections of what the plantation experience is from different sort of positions. And in different kind of ways, the works hopefully show how identities have also grown and resisted and survived through these processes. And it's the relationship and bonds between women that have actually created the matriarchy, that has created the spaces of survival. And so I guess in that sense, Creole identities being born in a way that sort of denote that kind of survival. Yeah, mama. So what does art bring to these questions that are often perceived as very political and perhaps exist in other spheres of society? Well, I guess, you know, being able to experience and think about these questions in a way that is not just literal factual lines, but allows us to enter spaces where we can, you know, connect to things in terms of emotional landscapes. And that's what starts to bring us towards these questions about the language of resilience and survival. And how does one imagine yourself as being anything other than what you told you are? How do you do that in an environment where there is no escape? There is only a reductionist narrative for you, the world of slavery, the world of the plantation. How does one grow out of that? Because in a sense, we are the proof of survival because we are here.
We have to fight for also our own philosophy of visibility.
Someone whose writing and research has been particularly pertinent to my work for many, many years is François Vergès, who is an academic, curator, theorist, and activist. Françoise's work is particularly inspirational to me because she overlaps the same area that my work resonates with, that my work has picked up upon. And so she has been and continues to be like almost exclusively the source of inspiration to my work, theoretically.
What makes the story of the Indian Ocean interesting and different from the Atlantic? First, the ocean as a cultural space is not defined by European, is not a white space, neither like the Black Atlantic of Paul Gilroy. It's something already from the beginning, a space of encounter and exchange between Africa and Asia. Long before the European arrive, there was a millenary history of exchange, of pilgrims, of traders, of merchants, of soldiers, of enslaved or sailors and captain who circulate from the African continent, from the East of African continent to Asia. And of course, from Madagascar as well, which is quite often forgotten also in the history of, you know, the global history of enslavement and colonialism. So that's the beginning. Second, in the Indian Ocean, we can say that processes of colonization precede the arrival of European. There are local, regional processes of colonization. The Swahili civilization can be seen. The Swahili architecture, the Swahili culture, language are effectively the result of processes of colonization. Third, there is also, from the beginning, in the colony, the slave colony of the Indian Ocean, an encounter between very different population, not just from, I mean, the enslaved do not come only from Africa. So you find, in fact, enslaved from Malaysia, quite early among the population. So you have a very strong, effectively, hybridity that will be expressed in the language and culture. And even today, the Indian Ocean is especially very specific and very different from the Atlantic. And there is a marginalization of the Indian Ocean, some form of blindness in Europe, because it's part of their history. They can say, we shape the Atlantic. The Atlantic was born of our, you know, present there. They cannot say that for the Indian Ocean.
So I suppose we can also understand the Indian Ocean is also as a site of both origin, but also as hybridity in terms of creolization, and perhaps then also the idea that of creole identity as in itself a form of resistance. So in your home of La Réunion, how do you feel that language and the naming or articulation of different histories has manifested? Not just perhaps spoken language, but the language of objects, of making, of creativity.
Yes, language is not about just a spoken word, but also about the ritual, the song, the poetry, the practice around plants, the knowledge. About those. These are language of resistance. I'm sure you know that, Shiraz, the way women use their hands, the gesture that are made with the hands, you know, the way of holding one's body, the way of holding children, all these are also just, I mean, a language of resistance, of a creation outside of the norm of the white supremacy, of something that even under the eyes of the white supremacists were there. And the white supremacists did not see them, but, you know, they just saw, you know, like subhuman being, but this were there. All the rituals around the birth, around death, were also language of resistance, of, okay, you don't name us, but we have name for our ancestor, and we will go to their grave. And if they don't have grave, like for instance, for the enslaved who were thrown in mass grave and did not have, there was not a name, we will have ritual all night long, and we will talk to them, and we will give them food, and we will give them water. So all this are language of resistance. The way you built your house, the way you do the garden, you know. So all this, you know, aesthetic is also a form of language.
Yes, absolutely. And it's beautiful the way that you also describe the use of plants and the planting and the gardening. In fact, when I first began to shift my practice and my focus of my work many, many, many years ago, it was sitting, actually, the photograph that you see behind me now, this my grandmother's house. It was this site that really made me really think about what are the ways that we allow things to be preserved and the things that we allow to fall away. What are, you know, how we allow certain parts of the imposed culture that we absorb in, and how other parts of it we resist by letting them decay. And seeing this garden at my grandmother's house, which is a terrace garden, on top of the old Governor de Forges house. But it is filled with all of these little tin pots from the different foods and things over the years, and every type of plant grows in it. For me, this was so much of the language of how we've had to learn to live with these monoliths of empire.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, in the museum we imagined for Réunion Island, we wanted to have a garden that would be of exchange, that the garden would be done by the people who will come. So, you know, all the debate or discussion you can have around one plant. Oh, I use this for that. Oh, you do that. And yes, I do, you know, some tea with it. And this is good for this and this is good for that. People, there would be that moment of exchange. So it would not be selling. It would be an exchange.
And I suppose this can perhaps lead us to this interesting question about the plantation scene in contrast, you know, the idea of the plantation scene in contrast to the Anthropocene and this history of extractivism. And I suppose in a sense, we're talking about these plants in these little vessels, in these little tin cans, as being almost a resistance towards the wider landscape of which we exist within on the islands, which are completely controlled plantation landscapes in a sense, right? Perhaps there is a kind of relation between those two parts of extractivism.
Yeah, I mean, when we arrive in Mauritius or in Réunion today, when we see this landscape that are, you know, appear then on postcard for the tourist, they are not. I mean, they are totally fabricated. To have a sugar cane field or tea plantation, you know, forests have been to have been destroyed. And of course, in Mauritius, you have the famous destruction of the Black Ebony Forest by the Dutch. So it's absolutely, it's a landscape fabricated for extractivism. You know, when we look at the road, it's not the road that we would have built, you know, that would have connected that village to that village. They absolutely follow from plantation to the port from which effectively the sugar or the tea will be leaving. And you are forbidden to circulate freely. The enslaved cannot leave the plantation or cannot go and back and forth. But within that, they were able to take away from the slave owner a small place where they will effectively cultivate their own plants. And that, the way they appropriated that small space was effectively there within the master house, the small place of resistance and also of knowledge and practice. So within the plantation already, there were carved space on the plantation itself of marooning philosophy and practice. And of course, you had then the Maroon community, the totally sovereign Maroon community of those who left the plantation and carved their own space in the mountain and the moon in Mauritius. So yes, the plantation was an imposition of extractivism yesterday and today has not changed. And today in Mauritius is still tea plantation and sugarcane or resort. Tourism is a form of extractivism. It's cultural extractivism.
Yes. And as you were describing also, for example, the roads that we would not have built for ourselves, the roads that did not connect villages. So in Mauritius, we have the Chamarelle Valley that I'm sure you know, and has today become a major site of Maroon patrimony, we could almost say in a strange way. And on the other side of the mountain, or to descend down to the east coast, to the west coast, there is another little village at the bottom of that mountain. And so I remember often speaking to the villagers of Chamarelle and the other village of which I forget the name, that the young people, when they wanted to go and see the other young people, you know, at night, they wanted to go and see the girlfriend or the boyfriends, they would have to descend down the mountainside because there was never a road that connected these villages. And this is in the post-abolition period as well. So it's not until actually much more recently, you know, in the last 20 years that a mountain road has been built. So before that, these young people would have to descend down the mountain, perhaps with torches or lanterns, just to try and meet each other. But this became almost a ceremonial practice. It was in itself a form of resistance, of not being denied this access to the other half of your community, as it were.
Yeah, contrary to what usually we think, the enslaved during the night, they were, you know, going to meet other people on their plantation, either a man who had been separated from his wife or to meet his children or a woman. They were circulation and circulation of ideas and news.
Yes.
In fact, the news about insurrection or someone was marooned from the other plantation circulated very fast. People knew. And also the slave who were domestic slave, you know, and they were listening to the conversation, you know, during dinner. And because the white were talking in front of them, because for the white, they were objects, you know, they were like a piece of furniture. But they were listening carefully and bring back the news to the community of the enslaved. This is also how, for instance, oh, there is a revolution in France. They have been declaring that, you know, all men, I mean, this was men, are, you know, born equal. Then, okay, let's take that seriously. Then we are equal. Then we are free. And that sometimes surprised the white, because the white, I mean, thought that these people were too stupid, that this was the way they had to justify also enslavement. And the circulation from plantation of information, even it was also, oh, that person got married to that person, or that person got a kid, or that person died, were part of this a form of a circulation of information that totally escaped the white supremacist world.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I can completely imagine to a certain degree that, for example, when the revolution is taking place in where, what is now Haiti, how that news, when it arrives in L'Île Maurice, actually the plantation owners of L'Île Maurice, they petition Napoleon to return the system of slavery. They were one of the major voices to persuade him to bring back, because they are then saying that what happens in Haiti will now take place in all of your colonies, and the money that is fueling, that is paying for your armies, as it were, to continue on their crusades through Europe, will lose its funding. So,
and let's remember, Shira, that the abolition of 1794 was refused by the slave owner of what was Ile-de-France and in Bourbon at the time. Whereas, you know, in Guadeloupe and Guyana, I mean, Martinique was under the English domination. But that says something about the kind of slave ownership we had on these two highlands of absolutely very reactionary, very white supremacist.
Yes, yes. As we've spoken about the landscape as an archive in itself, and how the land sort of and the region bears witness both to the history and to the trauma, one of the things that we have often come back to is how to develop a language of resistance while still being situated within this colonial reality, which I know that in some people like to call it the post-colonial presence, but actually we know that we are still within the same colonial system, really, as we always have been. So perhaps we can talk a little bit as this final point about how your own ideas in developing this politic of visibility and invisibility and to counter this continuous racist gaze. And perhaps also what I really enjoyed reading was your essay that you did for Documenta 14, which was, you know, about people who perhaps those of us who are left that have to continue to fight regardless of how these conversations shift in the global focus. That for us who not left behind, but continue to have to push for this.
Yeah, we have to push for this and we have to invent. I mean, we say that, and it has been an historical, theory about that. Our ancestors did it. We have to fight for also our own philosophy of visibility. Because what is visible has been at the heart of white supremacy and Western hegemony. They show through images the hierarchy of race. I mean, you know, so that the white were on the top. So it's not just that we have to undo that. We have also to invent, to go beyond the frame of representation that is imposed by the West. It's not just to say, oh, you have forgotten that and we are there, because we are not forgotten chapter of their history. They are a little chapter in our history. Europe is a little chapter in the history of the world and a little chapter in the history of the Indian Ocean. So we have to reverse, we have to start from our history. So we don't also look for the same frame of representation that has been imposed by the West. And also about invisibility, there are some moments we still have to become invisible again. We have to hide. I mean, this idea that everything has to be visible, everything has to be shown, everything has to become a commodity, that also neoliberalism, you know, capitalism. So no, there are things that you don't show, that they're, you know, that they are private, that there are things like that. I mean, the way even, you know, even rituals that are so intimate has to be filmed and shown because for consumption, oh, that's so exotic, or that's fantastic. And we get caught in that sometimes. So how do we even, you know, represent this ritual? How do we try to say something without effectively using the same tools? And so that's a work that artists have been doing, but also literature, poetry, songs, or what is called nonfiction narrative. So I think we have to continue to do that, to explore that, but we have really to unlearn, to learn again.
I mean, my grandmother, she definitely taught me how to survive. She taught me so many deep little conversations about how to carry parts of my identity visually, and how to keep parts of it secret, she said, to carry parts of it just inside your sleeve, that not everybody needs to know everything about you, but that you carry yourself in certain ways. And I knew there was so much really very special sort of knowledge, wisdom that she was passing down. One of our more ancestral grandmothers, her name was Charmant. She was, as we know, under the British registration of slaves in the just before abolition in the earlier part of 19th century, they were directing all of the French plantation owners to name their slaves, as they were doing in the Caribbean. And unlike in the Caribbean, where most of the slaves were given the names of their slave masters or the plantations, people in Maurice have names like cooking pot, or lazy, or all of these different words that actually related to the job they were doing. So the fact that the names that these individuals were calling themselves were not known by their owners, it says a lot about the dehumanization and objectification, as you describe. But this grandmother of mine, she was called Charmant, so we know that she was a house slave, because this was the name that was given to her, Charming. And I continuously arrive back at these points of what that world that she had to stand in. And when she marries an Indian immigrant who has arrived in Port Louis, and this is where she converts from Catholicism and the family becomes an Islamic family. And it's quite interesting to see that in this period, the fluidity of identity is changing. People are not necessarily changing their spiritual beliefs, but they are perhaps changing the identity or the name, the way that they're visually connected in communities, in order to try and reposition, to maneuver themselves through the colonial society within these very, very small corridors that are allowed.
And what you say also, it's a circulation even of the possibility of circulation without feeling that you are betraying whatever, you know, because there is a form of arrangement that the white cannot understand, and they want to categorize people, either the Hindu, in the Muslim, in the Catholic. But people circulate also. They circulate. You will address that god for dancing, and we'll go to the goddess here. And while by doing that, you are not renouncing the spiritual education or formation in which, you know, to which you identify. It's not lived as a conflict. It's lived as a possibility. So the Creole philosophy of life is not just to speak Creole or whatever. It's effectively an incredible, terrible circumstances of not, which was not of our choosing. We nonetheless built a humanity, a decency, a possibility of, you know, of effective empathy and solidarity.
Thank you so much, Françoise. So inspiring and so generous as always.
Thank you, Shiraz.
After speaking with Françoise, what I find, I mean, there is nobody else out of the region that speaks in this way. Every time I speak to her, it's just like it just sort of affirms all these things that I've been looking at or thinking about over the years. It's really, really amazing. It's such a privilege to talk to her. And as an artist, it is also really quite extraordinary to be able to connect with a theorist, a writer, whose work is so poignant for this moment and really does exactly exemplify what motivates me as an artist.
I'm of Caribbean heritage. I grew up in Antigua and Barbuda, which is also a former plantation colony. So the questions raised here by Shiraz and Françoise feel very urgent to me. Not least because these islands are already feeling the effects of the climate crisis. So I think it's important that we continue having these conversations in a space like Somerset House, which of course has its own specific history in relation to colonialism. Thanks to Shiraz Beju and Françoise Vergès. The theme music is by Car Beard, with additional music by Alan Castell, Menoir, Caméléon, and Roger George. This series is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. Next episode, we'll be taking fun seriously with composer and resident artist here, Anna Meredith.